Okay. Amory Levins, are you there?
Yes.
Okay, great. I just wanted to always like to check and make sure that the Death Star that mutes everybody else's line worked, and apparently it does because I can hear you, and everybody else's line should be muted now. So welcome, everybody, to the February Citizens Climate Lobby International Call. For those of you who are new to this call is a very big part of the structure of support that we have that is designed to fulfill on two commitments. We have two things that we're really oriented around. One is creating the political will for a sustainable and stable climate. One of the premises we start from is that politicians generally respond to political will, they don't create it. So we're in the business of creating political will so that it's easy for them to pass effective legislation in the U.S. and Canada. The second commitment that we're organized around is empowering people to have breakthroughs in their personal and political power. So we're betting on the human factor in solving the planet's climate crisis. And so this call is very much a structure to support both getting legislation passed, but also to empower people in being effective in the face of a very, very large challenge. What's going to be happening on today's call is in just a moment we'll be introducing Mr. Amory Levins, our guest speaker, who we're very excited to have. After his comments, it's possible there'll be time for questions. If there are, we'll start in Philadelphia, Lincroft, New Jersey, and then Toronto. Sometimes there is, sometimes there's not. After that, we'll get a report of what's happened since last month's call, and as you'll see, once again, everybody made a lot of things happen over the course of the month. And then the last thing we'll do on today's call is practice the laser talk that's related to this month's action and then ask everybody to make a commitment about the things that are going to get done between now and next month's call. Before that, the last thing I'd like to mention is I'd like to welcome our two newest groups. Last Saturday, we were in Philadelphia at a beautiful synagogue that was a converted linen factory. I don't think you'd usually think of an old linen factory as being a beautiful building, but it was fantastic, and there were 25 really committed, great people. That was wonderful. Peter, that's a really, really beautiful job of organizing. And then we were at Lynn and Jan's house in Lincroft, New Jersey. Michael and Lynn, again, a really great job of organizing. They had a room that they converted into a music room, so there was a big, beautiful grand piano and all kinds of other music-related paraphernalia, you know, things you could read to play and instruments and stuff. And again, the room was packed, and that was really, really special. And then we finished off that trip Monday morning with a meeting with the editorial board at the Philadelphia Inquirer. And so the entire board was there, which was really, really nice. They promised us a half hour and gave us 45 minutes, so that's always a good indication that we're getting the kind of work done that we want to get done is when people ask us to spend more time with them. I admit that I had a little bit of a personal breakthrough in sustainability on the way to the Philadelphia Inquirer in that pipes broke where I was staying, so I found out that you can shower, shave, and brush your teeth with one glass of water. That was a bit of a breakthrough for me. Anyway, Mr. Levins, we are so excited to have you on the call. I love your book, Reinventing Fire. We would love to hear any comments you have about that or the work that you've done with many corporations around the world. Obviously, so many of the awards you've received are because of the really remarkable things you've done to bring to get bear great thinking in the area of efficiency from everything from transportation to building design, etc. I do also, I couldn't help but note that you're just the only bio that we've ever gotten that says you're a Harvard and Oxford dropout. we haven't had anybody else who have ever focused on the schools that they actually left, so I want you to know that was really impressive and jumped off the page at me. So anyway, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us, and we're glad to have you. Good morning.
Good morning. I'd like to summarize what we found in the most ambitious effort Rocky Mountain Institute's ever undertaken, and we're not noted for lacking ambition. It's a business book called Reinventing Fire, Bold Business Solutions for the New Energy Era, published last October by Chelsea Green, and also a supporting website with all the technical details, and it's a portal to our implementing initiatives and other materials. That's at reinventingfire.com. The title of the book reflects its ambition, namely that fire made us human, fossil fuels made us modern, We now need a new fire that makes us healthy, safe, secure, and durable. So this work describes how to shift the U.S., for starters, completely from oil and coal to efficient use and renewables. And we explain how saving and displacing those fossil fuels can now work better and cost less than buying and burning them. Of course, that's not where we are now. Four-fifths of the world's energy is still coming from burning every year a little over 4 cubic miles of the rotted remains of primeval swamp goo. Credit where it's due, that stuff has built our civilization. It's created our wealth. It has enriched the lives of billions. It just happens to have rising costs to security, economy, health, and environment that are eroding and even outweighing benefits. That's why we need a new fire. And this requires two big shifts in oil and in electricity. These two are often confused, but of course they're distinct. Less than 1% of our oil, but 95% of our coal makes electricity. Oil and power plants each release 2/5 of fossil carbon, and they have quite concentrated uses. 3/4 of the oil fuels transportation, 3/4 of the electricity powers buildings, the rest of the oil and electricity runs factories. So very efficient vehicles, buildings, and factories can save oil and coal, and for that matter, natural gas that can displace them both. So I'm going to summarize how we can move from our aging, insecure, dirty energy system to an efficient, connected, and distributed one, where super efficient autos, buildings, and factories all rely on a secure, modern, resilient, and renewable electricity system. So when you get through doing this, you get quite a remarkable result. We assume that the U.S. economy in 2050 would be 2.6 times what it is now. That's extrapolating official projections. And nonetheless showed how to run that much larger economy with no oil, no coal, no nuclear energy, a third less natural gas, at a $5 trillion lower net present value cost than business as usual. That assumes that all externalities are worth zero, a conservatively low estimate. And we found that the transition would need no new inventions, no act of Congress, and could be led by business for profit. In other words, this energy solution is designed and driven by the C-suite, not by K Street. We're suggesting how to use our most effective institutions, the private sector in coevolution with civil society and sped by military innovation, to end run our least effective institutions, notably Congress. The way we do this is very trans-ideological. That is, whether you care most about profits and jobs and competitive advantage, or about national security, or about environmental stewardship and climate and public health, reinventing fire makes sense and makes money. We're focusing here on outcomes, not motives, and we're getting, therefore, a very encouraging response across the political spectrum. Now, to achieve these astonishing results, we're following advice reputedly from General Eisenhower that expanding the boundaries of a tough problem makes it soluble by encompassing more options and more synergies. He allegedly said, if a problem cannot be solved, enlarge it. So in Reinventing Fire, we integrate all four energy-using sectors, transportation, buildings, industry, and electricity, and we integrate four kinds of innovation, not just in technology and policy, but also in design and business strategy. And those combinations yield a lot more than the sum of the parts. Let me start with autos, which use 3/5 of our mobility fuel, which is almost all oil. How can we make those autos oil-free and therefore avoid the $2 billion a day that the U.S. spends buying oil and the $4-plus billion a day of externalities from that oil? Well, 2/3 of the energy needed to move a typical car is caused by its weight. For the past quarter century, though, our cars have had an epidemic of obesity. They now weigh 2 tons, and they're gaining weight twice as fast as we have. But ultralight, ultra-strong materials, notably carbon fiber composites, can make dramatic weight savings snowball and can make the auto simpler and cheaper to build. Lighter and more slippery autos also need less force to move them so their engine shrinks, and that sort of vehicle fitness then makes electric autos affordable because their batteries or fuel cells get smaller, lighter, and cheaper. Therefore, their sticker price falls to about today's level with far lower driving costs. You therefore can exploit three very steep learning curves of decreasing cost with increasing production volume in the materials, their structural manufacturing, and electric propulsion. And the combination is as big a game changer as switching from, say, typewriters to computers. Initially, the electrified autos do cost more, but that can be bridged with a temporary fee bait, that is, a rebate for efficient new autos paid for by fees on inefficient ones of the same size class. That's already being done in varying ways in 5 European countries, and in the biggest one in France, just the first 2 years tripled the speed of improving automotive efficiency. The U.S. could be leading this automotive revolution. Currently, the leader is Germany. Volkswagen, Audi, and BMW have all announced that by 2013 they will be producing in volume electrified carbon fiber cars. BMW confirms that the carbon fiber in theirs is paid for by needing fewer batteries, and their CEO gives speeches saying, "We do not intend to be a typewriter maker." The even newer manufacturing technologies developed in the U.S. can scale to automotive cost and speed and ultimately save 4/5 of the capital needed for automaking. It's equivalent in oil savings to finding a Saudi Arabia under Detroit, actually 1.5 Saudis or half an OPEC by 2050. The same physics and the same business logic also apply to big vehicles. Walmart has saved 60% of its fuel per ton mile in its giant heavy truck fleet in the past 5 years. Technological saving alone, not counting logistics, which they also improved, can rise to 2/3. We can also do triple to quintuple efficiency airplanes, and all that stuff is worth almost $1 trillion. The automotive improvements are worth about $4 trillion. And there's a military revolution in energy efficiency going on that will speed all of these civilian advances, much as military R&D created the internet and GPS and the jet engine and microchip industries. We also looked at how to use vehicles smarter by charging real-time driving costs per mile, not per gallon, using smart IT and information technology to enhance transit and empower car sharing and ride sharing, allow lucrative smart growth real estate models so people are already where they want to be, and using information technology to make traffic free-flowing. When you add all that up, it turns out you can get the same or better access in the U.S. with 46% to 84% less driving. So when you add all this up, a far more mobile U.S. economy 40 years hence can use no oil. And what do you run it on? Well, the cars get the equivalent of 125 to 240 miles a gallon. Remember, they're electrified. And they can use any mixture of electricity, hydrogen fuel cells, and advanced biofuels. The trucks and planes can realistically use advanced biofuels or hydrogen. Trucks can even burn natural gas, but no vehicles will need oil. The most biofuel we might need is less than a quarter of what we now use in gasoline for mobility. 2/3 of it can come from waste, and the rest wouldn't need to displace any cropland and wouldn't harm climate or soil fertility. The mainstream analysts, even 3 years ago, were starting to see peak oil not in supply but in demand. Deutsche Bank even forecast world oil use will peak around 2016. Because what's happening is oil is becoming uncompetitive even at low prices before it becomes unavailable even at high prices. It only costs $25 a barrel or so to get U.S. mobility completely off oil, and that's about a quarter of what we pay for the stuff. But electrified autos don't need to burden the electricity system. Rather, when smart autos exchange electricity and information with smart grids through smart buildings, they're adding flexibility and storage to the grid that help to integrate solar and wind power. So electrified autos make the auto and electricity problems easier to solve together than separately, and they converge the oil story for the first time with our second big story, which is about saving electricity and then making it differently. Most of our electricity is wasted. The technologies for saving it keep improving faster than they're being installed, so the savings keep getting bigger and cheaper. And we found that buildings by 2050 could triple or quadruple their energy productivity, saving $1.4 trillion net with a 33% internal rate of return. In other words, the savings are worth four times their costs. Industry can also double its energy productivity with a 21% IRR. And in analyzing both those sectors, we applied, I think conservatively, a disruptive innovation we developed called integrative design that can often make very large energy savings cost less than small or no savings, thus turning diminishing into expanding returns. That's how our retrofit in 2010 is saving over two-fifths of the Empire State Building's energy. We remanufactured its 6,500 windows on site into super windows that admit light but block heat. That and other improvements cut the cooling load on the hottest days by a third. Then we could renovate smaller chillers instead of adding bigger ones, saving over half the total capital cost of the retrofit. So by helping to pay for other improvements, that $17 million saving cut the payback to 3 years, and they're saving over two-fifths of the energy. Integrative design is also very powerful in smaller buildings. I'm talking to you from a house where I'm ripening my three latest banana crops, number 37 through 39, with no furnace at 7,100 feet in the Rockies, where it used to go to minus 47F. And today's technologies are even better. We've actually eliminated a heating system in this house and cooling systems in other houses up to at least 115 at 46C with about normal construction cost and better comfort. In industry, integrative design is also very powerful. For example, you can save typically around 90% of the energy in pumping loops, pumping being the biggest use of motors, by using fat, short, straight pipes instead of skinny, long, crooked pipes. Not only that, but every unit of fuel you save by taking friction out of the pipes saves 10 times that much fuel back at the power plant. And we found these kinds of snowballing energy savings in over $30 billion worth of industrial redesigns in many, many different sectors with very attractive returns. Now, if you add up the efficiency gains in industry and buildings, they actually start to outpace economic growth. So electricity use with the electrified cars starts shrinking slightly. That makes it easier to displace the supply with renewables. China, of course, is leading renewables explosive growth and plummeting costs. And already in about 20 states, private installers can put solar cells on your roof with no money down and beat your utility bill. This is a radical bypass of existing power companies. It could end up with what you might think of as a virtual utility that does everything that your utility does now, but at lower and constant price with no emissions and with greater reliability and resilience. That kind of thing gives utility executives the heebie-jeebies, but it gives venture capitalists sweet dreams. Well, over the past 4 years, half of the world's new generating capacity has been renewables. In 2010, renewables except big hydro got $151 billion of private investment worldwide, they surpassed global installed nuclear capacity by adding 60 billion watts. And in fact, that the world can now make 60 billion watts worth of photovoltaics every year. In contrast, the orders for coal and nuclear plants are fading because they have too much cost and too much financial risk. In Reinventing Fire, we looked at different ways of replacing the aging, dirty, insecure electricity system we've got, because it has to be replaced anyway by 2050. And it turns out that whatever we replace it with is going to cost about the same, roughly $6 trillion net present value, whether we buy more of what we've got, or new nuclear and so-called clean coal, or centralized renewables, or distributed renewables. The costs are the same, but they differ profoundly in risks around national security, fuel, water, finance, technology, climate, and health. For example, our over-centralized grid is very vulnerable to major cascading blackouts across regions or even a continental area that could last for months, years, or indefinitely, whether caused by bad space weather, other natural disasters, or terrorist attacks. But we found that that risk disappears and all the other risks are best managed with distributed renewables reorganized into local microgrids that normally interconnect but can stand alone at need. That's the approach the Pentagon is adopting for its own energy security. And this would cost about the same as business as usual, but it would maximize security, customer choice, entrepreneurial opportunity, and innovation. These kinds of shifts to efficiency and renewables and toward a more distributed, diverse power system are going fastest where regulators, as in about 14 states now, reward the utilities for cutting your bills, not for selling you more energy. And we're finding that very large 80 to 100% renewable fractions of electricity are feasible, reliable, and cost-effective, whether in small areas like the four German states that were 43 to 52% wind-powered in 2010, or even in a continental area where you properly choreograph many different kinds of varying and flexible resources. Now, if you put together the oil and electricity and efficiency revolutions I've mentioned, you end up with Reinventing Fire, where business enabled and sped by smart policies and demanding customers in mindful markets can lead the U.S. and I dare say many other countries completely off oil and coal by 2050, saving trillions of dollars in a lot of risk and insecurity. In the U.S. case, the carbon emissions end up 82 to 86% below the year 2000 level, not at a cost, but with a $5 trillion gain. So our energy future is not fate, but choice. That choice is extremely flexible. To solve the energy problem, we just needed to enlarge it. And if this sounds hard to believe, just remember Marshall McLuhan's remark that only puny secrets need protection. Big discoveries are protected by public incredulity. So we're doing a lot at RMI in implementing initiatives to help smart firms get unstuck and speed the journey. There is, of course, still a lot of old thinking around that we see in the media every day. As Canadian former woman Marie Strong said, not all the fossils are in the fuel. the former chairman of DuPont, Edgar Willard, reminds us that firms hampered by old thinking won't be a problem because in the long run they won't be around. So I've given you a lightning tour of not just a once-in-a-civilization business opportunity, but one of the biggest transformations in the history of our species. We're really inventing a new fire. It's not dug from below, but flowing from above. It's not scarce, but bountiful. Not local, but everywhere. Not transient, but permanent. Not costly, but free. But for a little biofuel grown in ways that sustain and endure, this new fire is flameless. If we use it efficiently, it can make energy do our work without working our undoing. So we're inviting you and all those in reach of your voice to come to reinventingfire.com, join the conversation, engage with us and each other, to help make the world richer, fairer, cooler, and safer by reinventing fire. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Amy. You know, one of the things that, well, not one of many of the things that are so encouraging about your comments is, you know, a lot of the motivation for us about putting a fee on carbon is, and then the elimination of all energy subsidies is because we believe the market is the most efficient way of solving this. So, you know, this is very, very good news to us that, you know, there are so many places where there are opportunities in the market and ones that are already being exploited. One thing that I loved reading about in your book was how efficient your own home is. Would you mind just saying just a little bit about that? Because there you live in the Rocky Mountains, but it seems like you're able to heat and cool your home with almost no energy being spent.
Yeah, we're actually fossil fuel-free, combustion-free, and a net energy exporter. Although I've got a little problem. We just did a major retrofit to bring the technologies up to date by a quarter century because it was turning into a museum of 1983 state-of-the-art. So we put in a monitoring system measuring about 300 data streams, and the problem is that the monitoring system seems to be using more electricity than the lights and appliances we're measuring. But that's a nice problem to have. It's a 99% passively heated building. That made it slightly cheaper to build because we saved more capital cost eliminating the heating system than we paid extra to get rid of it with super windows, super insulation, and ventilation heat recovery. That's basically the formula that later got adopted in so far 32,000 or so passive buildings in Europe and a handful in North America. And, of course, there have been spots of super insulation pioneering, as in, say, Saskatchewan in North America as well, some in Alaska, a few in the Midwest. But our best windows now, not counting the edge loss of the frame, insulate like 16 sheets of glass or in some cases 22, and they're about to get even better. And that sort of technology makes it hard to miss, even in a very cold place like here. We took the saved construction cost of about $1,100 plus another $6,000 and reinvested it up front in saving not just the 99% of the space heating energy, but also about 99% of the water heating and 90% of the electricity. And the whole thing was a 10-month payback in 1983, but today's technology is a lot better. And we've done the same trick, as I mentioned, up to 115F, getting rid of air conditioning. In fact, a friend in Bangkok was inspired by this house to build one there in a very hot, wet climate, saving 90% of the air conditioning energy with normal construction cost and superior comfort. So I think probably about everybody in the world lives in a climate somewhere between Bangkok and Old Snowmass, Colorado.
Right. Well, can you stand for a couple more minutes so I can give a couple
sure.
of groups a chance to ask questions? Okay, so let me just check with Philadelphia first. In Philadelphia, what you would need to do is hit *6 on your phone. That would unmute it. If you do have a question or not, if you could unmute yourself for a second, ask the question, and then if you would *6 again, it will remute the phone. So, Peter, does anybody in the Philadelphia group like to ask a question today? Just give them a moment.
Alan, do you have a question?
Well, I'm not sure how well formulated it is, but I recently looked at putting in a point of use, or actually it was a whole house water heater versus the gas water heater that I have, and it costs 3.5 times as much to have this electric water heater. In other words, it was much more expensive to put in a green water heater than the old technology, which is using gas. And I guess I'm trying to ask a general question about the dilemma faced by a typical homeowner here in the East with regard to moving to green technology. Without having specific numbers in front of me, I can't formulate the question any better than that.
Well, some green technologies cost more, others cost less, and I would urge you to shop carefully. And, you know, even though I keep up with this stuff full time, I'm still surprised by how rapid the progress is. My wife just put in a gas demand water heater at her studio, and the last I'd looked, they were only about 80% efficient, but this one's up around 97 or 98. and it'll pay for itself in a couple of years. Typically, the value proposition is just fine from a business perspective. The problem is most of us don't have the money up front. That's why things like PACE bonds, which are working for commercial, still stuck for residential, but I hope will get unstuck, or the on-bill financing that we have in New York State now, are critical because they give the homeowner access to the sort of cheap capital that the energy supply industries have, especially the regulated utilities. And that makes a much more level playing field. And sometimes, as in photovoltaics today, you even have a terrific value proposition where you don't need any money down to lower your electric bill by going solar. That's in about 20 states now, and it should spread to the rest of them over the next few years. But this is a financial, not an economic problem. I would also urge you, and we have an old book on this called Homemade Money, Saving Energy and Dollars in Your Home, to think about when you're going to do something major to your house. Like if it needed re-roofing, that would be the time to super insulate it. If you need to replace an appliance, that's the time to go super efficient. Go to ACEEE.org and get the ACEEE list of the most efficient stuff on the market. If your furnace is about to die, that's a great time to think about super insulation and maybe not needing a furnace. In fact, you already have a water heater. You still will have some manner of water heater. You could use a little backup heat from that and not need to put in a new furnace. So there are some interesting opportunities at different points in the life of the building where you can piggyback on stuff you're going to do anyway and therefore greatly reduce the net capital cost.
Great. Okay, we'll try and squeeze one more in if you can stick with us for just another moment here. So Lincroft, New Jersey, if you could unmute your phone, *6, let's see if you have a question there.
That's the other new group. Any question?
Anything, Lynn, Michael, anybody have a question there?
Hi, Ellie Whitney calling.
Yep.
I'd like to know what legislation would be useful in promoting and speeding up these transformations that you describe.
That's described in the book, and there are two big ones which actually don't require an act of Congress. They are new policies, and they can be done either administratively at a federal level or legislatively or sometimes administratively at a state level. So we can end run Congress either way. The two most important are what is called in the utility biz decoupling and shared savings, that is rewarding electric and gas utilities for cutting your bill, not for selling you more energy, just as sensible as it sounds. And, you know, 20 states have adopted or are considering it and more underway. And then secondly, for new cars, the size and revenue neutral fee bait that I mentioned, that's written up at RMI.org if you go to the search window in the upper right and enter fee bait, F-E-E-B-A-T-E. You'll get our report of a few years ago that we worked out with industry on how fee-based should be designed. And it turns out this can greatly improve profits for both automakers and dealers who are politically very powerful. There are a lot of little things to be fixed, barrier busting, the alchemy stumbling blocks into stepping stones in every sector. And at the end of each chapter, 2 through 5, you'll find a list of who needs to do what. I would just add one comment at the end here, and I want to thank you for your work trying to get carbon priced. That is appropriate, it's good economics, and it would be very helpful. However, our analysis did not show it was essential, and it's certainly not sufficient, because if you get the prices right and don't also bust the barriers, not much will happen. You'll be in the position DuPont was when they found that their European factories were using the same amount of fuel per pound of product as identical U.S. factories, even though in Europe they'd long paid twice the energy price, and the reason is the same people were designing the same plants in the same way, and there's not much room for behavioral change in a chemical plant. So we need to really dig into the 60 or 80 well-known market failures in buying efficiency. Each has a solution. Each can become a business opportunity. This requires the kind of relentless patience and meticulous attention to detail that movements like yours can bring at the grassroots level, and that is extremely important, and I applaud you for it.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being on. I'm hoping we can get you back again. You know, our San Jose group had originally alerted us to some of your work, and then they were so enthusiastic about getting you on, so were sending me things almost on a weekly basis of, then look at this, he said, and look at this thing he wrote. So, and I loved reading the book. So thank you so much for being on, and appreciate all of your work. And we do know that we need breakthroughs in thinking, and certainly the work that you're doing represents a huge piece of that, and we're really grateful for what you're doing and that you would spend part of your weekend with us.
Are we done with questions? Hello?
Yes, who's that?
This is Karen from Chicago.
Yes, can you mute your phone? We're going to be going on to the next part of the call in just a moment, Karen.
Oh, we have no more time for questions?
That's right. We're out of time for questions. Thank you. But if you want to ask a question on the next month's call, you can just send me a note.
So I could just email at RMI or something. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah,
all right.
And I'll drop off now. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, sir. Thank you so much. Great to have you on the call.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Okay, so we want to come to the second part of the call in that every month one of the things that we do is we get reports of what happened. And we'll get an overall report in just a couple of moments. But I always like to focus on a couple of specific things that have happened in the field. One thing that Amy will get to also in her overall report, I love that our group that hasn't even had their group start workshop in Michigan yet already went and had a meeting at Dave Camp's office. Why is Dave Camp important? Well, he's the head of the Ways and Means Committee. So for us to pass any of the kind of legislation we've talked about, Dave Camp is absolutely crucial. And so thank you, Michigan, for, you know, even though haven't even got back there for the group start, I love that type of initiative. Thank you for not waiting around. We're really glad that you had that meeting, and I think it was just in the last few days. Okay, so before we get to the overall report, I'd like to get one report from Canada and one from the U.S. So Christine from Red Lake, if you could unmute your phone, I'd like to hear a little bit about what happened over the last month with your group and up in Canada. Are you there, Christine? You have to hit *6. Christine? Okay, we'll circle back to Christine in a second. Let's go over to Richmond. Ellie, are you there in Richmond? Can you *6 and unmute your phone?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, and then we'll circle back to Red Lake after Richmond. Go ahead, Ellie. So the thing that I'd like to hear a little bit about is your group had a meeting with Representative Cantor's office, and as the majority leader and the second most powerful Republican in the House after Speaker Boehner, that's obviously a very, very important office from our perspective. And so I'd like to hear a little bit about the work that you did and the meeting itself with Representative Cantor's office.
Okay, terrific. So when CCL assigned the December action, which was to ask for a meeting with our member of Congress over winter break, four from our group volunteered. Jim was at his first CCL meeting in December, and his wife volunteered him for the job on the spot. And Jim secured a meeting with Eric Cantor's legislative director in mid-January. Prior to the meeting with the legislative director, Jim hosted two planning meetings at his house that lasted 2 hours each. Jim, who is very organized, prepared our agendas for our planning meetings and helped set our goal for our meeting with the legislative director. Our goal was that we wanted to help the congressman expand his thinking on energy, economy, and environment. Jim used a flip chart to keep us focused. He emailed a copy of our agenda to the legislative director prior to the meeting. Fred also brought his professional skills to the table. Fred has worked with organ donors, and he knows how to present a challenging subject for thoughtful consideration. Fred bought and read Dr. James Hansen's book, The Storms of My Grandchildren. He explored the Internet and focused in particular on climate deniers trying to understand their resistance. Richard is a retired naval oceanographer and meteorologist, so he brought his vast expertise on the science and deepened it with quotes from military leaders. So we drew on everybody's strengths, but we also strengthened our weak areas. I'm a big picture person, and it takes a lot for me to memorize details. Nonetheless, we each agreed to become experts in the provisions of the Save Our Climate Act. We combed over the act individually, and in our planning meetings, I dug deeper into the climate tax part, which is the section I adopted. So we arrived on the appointed day with our flip chart, our green economy book, and a printed agenda. And I have to say with some pride here that the legislative director told us we were the most prepared group he'd ever met with. We had written our scripts out in advance, and during our planning meetings, we read our scripts to each other and offered comments and corrections. We brought the scripts to the meeting with us, and I was in charge of introducing CCL and our team, so here's an excerpt from my script. Over the past year, CCL has doubled to 40 groups, with hundreds of volunteers who are meeting with members of Congress in the U.S. and members of Parliament in Canada. We are also forging relationships with editorial pages of local newspapers. Here is a summary of our work, and I handed him a copy of our press book. We are building the political will for a stable climate and facilitating breakthroughs in personal and political power. You might say we're here today looking for a climate hero. The likely climate heroes have self-identified. We're looking for unlikely climate heroes. Congressmen and women with strong ties to coal, oil, and natural gas, politicians connected to industry, statesmen respected by peers in their party, leaders for this most challenging of issues. We think Congressman Cantor can become our climate hero. We asked him to outline the congressman values on energy, economy, and environment, and we used the flip chart to document those values and confirm that we had heard accurately, and I think he valued that exercise. We went over the key components of the Save Our Climate Act, the scientific findings, the carbon tax, and the Climate Trust Fund. After presenting the science, we asked for his personal thoughts and responses. I went as far as asking him what he felt when he heard Richard describe the science, and I shared my feelings of concern. After listening to our descriptions of the carbon tax and the Climate Trust Fund, the legislative director had several higher-level questions. We took notes and promised to respond. The congressman is Jewish, and so is Fred, and we wanted to identify that commonality and extend our friendship. Fred is known among his friends here in Richmond for his fabulous baking skills, so he made two loaves of challah bread, one for the legislative director and the other for the congressman. Our team has met twice again for about an hour and a half each time to capture our impressions, investigate the questions that arose, and plan our next steps. We are using the same formula, divide the questions among our team, become expert on our assigned questions, and propose an agenda to the legislative director. We envision answering his questions over a series of three meetings, one per month during the spring, 45 minutes per meeting in Richmond or in D.C., and as we answer his questions, we envision expanding his and the congressman's grasp of the three areas, energy, economy, and environment, so that the sweet spot where they overlap is a carbon tax with revenue returned to American households. And we heard the Eisenhower quote just on Amory Lovin's talk, which is, if you can't solve the problem, expand it. So that's the idea we're bringing to the congressman. We want the legislative director to facilitate a meeting with Congressman Cantor and our team during the CCL National Conference in July, and we just this week sent an email proposing our agenda to the legislative director, and we're waiting for his response.
Great. Ellie, thank you so much. One of the things I love about the work that you did there is kind of to recontextualize what's happening. You know, sometimes we go in and we think we're trying to get certain points across or get, you know, certain points made. But in this case, it's almost like you created the context as you were there to interview them for a job. So that we know who all the likely climate heroes are. We're here to interview to see if you are potentially an unlikely climate hero. I love that. It kind of shifts the context of how we're working it. And thank you all down there for just the enormous amount of time that you put into it, and also just the brilliant and joyous way you went of organizing it and delivering it.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And I know, Christine, I remember it was going to be a fairly complicated process because of how you guys listened to the call up there in Red Lake. Have you been able to unmute your phone yet, and can we hear you yet?
Hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, success. We're a little slow, but we get there eventually. Okay, so up here in the great, so far still white north, here in Red Lake, we had one of our members took the initiative to contact our local newspaper and invite them to one of our meetings. So they came in January. The reporter spent about an hour and a half here. She talked to our group, and she also listened to the whole call, even though she was going to leave halfway through.
And the result was a pretty good-sized article in which she talked about both our local group and also reported on the speaker's points on carbon fee and dividend, and also talked about the CCL stats for the U.S. and Canada for 2011. So it turns out January was a good meeting for her to be at. And so that was pretty successful. And also here in Canada, although not in Red Lake, the CCL leaders in Sudbury, Kathy Orlando and Jerry LaBelle, met with the editorial board of the Sudbury Star, which is part of a right-leaning national newspaper chain, the Sun Media. And things went really well. They went so well, the Star asked what they wanted, and they rather audaciously asked for a monthly column, and that's what they were given. So I guess it reinforces what you say, Mark. Don't shrink from being audacious or outrageous.
Great. Great report, Christine. Fantastic work up there. Thank you such. Wonderful. I'm glad we could get you unmuted so we could hear that. Excellent. And Amy, we asked people last month to focus, because members of Parliament and Congress would be home in the district, we asked people to focus on getting meetings with local representatives. Amy, how'd we do?
Mark, can you hear me? Okay, great. We did really, really well. And I'm going to go through them relatively quickly here by the type of field activity. So starting with meetings with members of Congress, we had in Anchorage a meeting with Senator Begich, North San Diego County, Representative Bono Mack, San Francisco, two meetings with Representative Pelosi, one with Representative Lee and one with Senator Feinstein. In Marin, meetings with Senator Boxer and Representative Woolsey, San Jose, meeting with Representative Lofgren, also in the Bay Area, meeting with Representative Stark, in Lafayette, Representative Honda, in Washington, D.C., Senator Whitehouse, in Atlanta, two meetings with Representative Lewis, Lawrence, Representative Jenkins, Boston, meeting with Senator Kerry, Alexandria, Senator Klobuchar, Senator Franken, and Representative Peterson. In Albuquerque, Representative Heinrich and Representative Lujan. In Richmond, Representative Cantor. In Milwaukee, Representative Sensenbrenner. And also just in from Northern Michigan, Representative Camp. And that is a total of 23 meetings with member congressional offices, Mark. Really great job, everybody. Amazing. Now going over to letters to the editor, we've got South San Diego, one LTE, and I refer to these as LTEs, La Jolla one, Washington, D.C. one, Atlanta one, three in Chicago, one in Iowa City, two Princeton 1, York, Pennsylvania 2, Salt Lake City 4, Seattle 1, Whidbey Island 1, Milwaukee 1, Toronto 1, Red Lake 1, Edmonton 1. And that is also 23 for letters to the editors. Now, editorials, I'm going to go through these quickly. One editorial in the San Jose Mercury News, St. Louis editorial in St. Louis Today, York Dispatch, and then up to op-eds, we've got one in North County Times in San Diego, one op-ed in Alexandria, one op-ed in the York Dispatch, one in the Capital Times of Madison. And moving on to articles, we've got one article in the Salt Lake Tribune, one in Red Lake in the Northern Sun, and one in Waitsville, Vermont. Major blog posts, we've got one in the Huffington Post and two online publications in Chicago, one in online publication in Bemidji. Moving to TV, radio, video, we've got a video on the Times Times Dispatch site, and Million Letter March letters. We've got one in Salt Lake and 36 in Madison. an outreach and presentations. We've got in Berkeley two public presentations at Interfaith Forums. In Lafayette, one public presentation. In Atlanta, Georgia, two public presentations. In Lawrence, we've got the Sierra Club Kansas chapter passed resolutions to support the fee and dividend. In Lincroft, we've got a group start. In Philadelphia, we've got a group start. In York, we've got a meeting with the Evangelical Environmental Network. In Salt Lake City, we have a CCL member, Joe Andrade, and he's decided to run for Congress in the 2nd District of Utah. We've got one public presentation in Seattle. Madison had a public presentation, met with a congressional candidate, and tabled at a farmer's market. And in Milwaukee, we've got a meeting with the candidate who is running for Tammy Baldwin's seat, congressional seat. Toronto, meeting with the Anglican Church. Sudbury spoke at a CCL member spoke at a town hall. In Edmonton, a CCL member blog post. And one column that I just see that I missed is editorial board meetings. We had one in Bemidji with, that was actually in December, local editorial board, and a editorial board meeting with the Philadelphia Inquirer, and then, as mentioned already, the Sudbury Star editorial board meeting. So great month, Mark.
Yeah, really, really great work, everybody. You know, sometimes you think, well, January is kind of a shortened month because of holidays and everything. That's really a remarkable amount of activity. Great work, everybody. Thanks for everything that you did. In Canada, one thing I do want to mention, the NDP leadership debate is tomorrow. So if those of you who want to weigh in with your members of parliament, please make sure that you're reaching out to them between now and tomorrow. One other thing I want to mention is Chris Bird is the head of our group in Tallahassee, and he's also been leading up, along with Lockie Au, my intern, researching how we harmonize international agreements based on carbon pricing. And part of that process, Chris and Lockie interviewed a gentleman by the name of Joost Pauwelen, who lives in Geneva, and that's when they spoke with him, who's considered the world's leading expert on what will meet WTO scrutiny or not. Well, he was so impressed with his interview with Chris and Lockie that he offered to have some people who he's supervising research anything that we wanted researching regarding the harmonization of international agreements regarding carbon pricing. So what they're going to be doing over the course of the spring is doing some research for us about how you harmonize different countries that are using different carbon pricing mechanisms. So you have Australia that just passed a carbon tax, but you have the EU that has cap and trade. So given that we have to deal with this issue from the broadest possible perspective, including how do countries relate to each other based on their carbon pricing mechanism, it's information that we have to make available to people. So anyway, we expect that information to be available late spring, early summer, and that will be available at the very latest at the National Conference in July. Okay, so in just a moment, Steve's going to go over our laser talk in support of the actions that we're asking people to take. So there's three things we're asking. First of all, always that you practice the laser talk. We can't ever practice those too much, so that's always going to be the first thing we ask you to do is practice the talk that Steve's going to go over in just a moment. But then there's two things. Both for the U.S. and Canada, we're asking you to, for everybody who's coming to the conference, to go ahead and register. We want to try and get as much of the Congress covered as we possibly can, and we want to know that the woman power and man power will be there to cover the conference. The conference is in Washington, D.C., July 22nd through 24th. Sunday, the 22nd, will be an evening lobby preparation. All day Monday will be educational sessions, and then Tuesday will be on the Hill lobbying members of Congress. There is a sliding scale of you can register for the conference from anywhere from $50 to $150. Do whatever appropriate for you. If you decide to register with more than that, that money will be put in a special fund, and people who are requesting assistance in getting to the conference, they could apply for that money. I want to point to how important it is that Canadians come down again this year, not only for the World Bank work that we've been doing, but also with members of Congress. Cheryl McNamara, who's the group leader in Toronto, and I were in Senator Maria Cantwell's office of Washington last year and had a very good meeting with her. I was in her office 7 months later waiting to meet with her staff member, Amit Ronan, And she was hosting a group of 20 people from Seattle and was walking out of the office to take pictures. She saw me across the lobby, walked over to say hi, and it's nice to see me again. I'm saying, I've met her once. I said, oh, you remember us? And she goes, yes, you were with that woman from Toronto who took the bus all the way from the Toronto to lower her carbon footprint. It was impressive. So it made a big impression having people from Canada at the conference. I'm really strongly encouraging you to be there again, not just for the World Bank, but also for the impact it made on congressional offices. The second thing we're asking everybody to do is to get letters of support in the community. In Canada, it's more of a generic letter in that it's asking for people to support carbon fee and dividend. And in the U.S., it'll be more specifically targeted to the Save Our Climate Act. One of the things we often get asked when we meet with members of Congress is, who else supports this? And we're in an extremely cautious political environment, so what we want to do is show people that there's support in the community. So you could reach out to organizations, but certainly people who are of influence, whose names people would recognize. You could ask them to sign it as individuals also. So if you are not a group leader, therefore you probably didn't get a copy of the actual paper that you would use as a sign-on process, you could go to the participation tab on our website, flip down to the line that says resources, and the first thing there will be that sign-on letter. The process is fairly simple in the U.S. When you send that letter electronically to people, all they have to do is send you back an email saying, yes, I support this. You forward it on to Steve Volk, whose address is on the action sheet, and we will begin compiling a list of people internationally and by community who say to support this. That Canadian process is even a little bit simpler in that it's linked to the Canadian homepage. All the people have to do is sign up there, hit the I'm in button, and it'll go straight to the Canadian page. So it's a little bit simpler on the Canadian side. On the U.S. side, as people say they support it, all they have to do is send you back a confirming email. We do ask for their name and organization, and then you'll forward that on to Steve, and we'll start compiling so that we can say, in addition to other people who have agreed to co-sponsor the Save Our Climate Act, which we in no way want to back off on, every single U.S. congressional meeting and with House of Representative members should still include becoming co-signers, but that we can show people their support from these companies, from these faith-based organizations, and these community leaders. So that's the thing that we want you to focus on for not just this month, but between now and the conference, so we can show a broad pace of support out in the community. Okay, so Steve, we have a specific laser talk for people to prepare in communicating with people about that action. Can you read that for us? Steve Volk?
I just star six. Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Okay, great. So here's the laser talk. As Mark mentioned, this is geared toward inviting folks to sign on to the letter of support for the Stark bill. And this is it. As we saw from the record number of weather-related disasters last year, floods, droughts, and fires, climate change is already having an impact on our world. The International Energy Agency has warned that we have 5 years to start reducing greenhouse gas emissions before the global warming process becomes unmanageable. The best way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, especially carbon dioxide, is to make the transition from fossil fuels to clean energy. Doing this will also create millions of jobs in clean energy and energy efficiency. We can speed up this transition by placing a gradually rising fee on carbon-based fuels that motivates private sector investments in wind, solar, and other clean technology. Returning revenue from the carbon fee to consumers will shield households from the economic impact of rising energy costs. The Save Our Climate Act, H.R. 3242, would do all this. But as we ask members of Congress to support this legislation, they ask the question, who supports this bill? And so we are asking organizations, faith communities, businesses, and people of influence to sign on to a letter of support for H.R. 3242. Can you or your organization sign this letter?
Great. Okay, so there's a copy that letter both on the website. It's also was sent out all to the group leaders, so it should be easy to distribute. Again, the process is very straightforward. As you reach out to organizations and they say, yes, we support it, they should send you back an electronic message saying so. You forward those on to Steve Ball. We're hoping you'll certainly keep track of those in your community so you can show people in your state office holders that there is support. On the Canadian version, it's going to be just straightforward on a fee and dividend, and with U.S., it will be about specifically the Save Our Climate Act. And again, if you're planning to come to the conference, the other reason that I'm recommending that you register now is we are saving the we're doing the conference in the same hotel that Results is having their international conference on the same dates in Washington, D.C. It created a lot of efficiency and cost reduction by combining where the conferences are being held. That being said, it's going to put an increased demand on the number of hotel rooms that we have blocked. So there's an initial group of rooms that are discounted to $155. When those get taken up, then it goes up to $189. You can stay up to four people in a room. So part of the reason that we also like you to register early is so you can take advantage of the discounts we negotiated with the hotel where the conference was being held. All right, everybody. So that was an amazing month that you produced. I'm expecting great things again this month, including getting co-sponsors, getting people to say that they'll support the act, having people register for the conference, continuing to get letters, continuing to meet with members of Congress. I want to leave you with one thing. When we went to the synagogue in Philadelphia, we were, as I said, in a converted linen factory. And we went upstairs where the meeting was going to be, and there was a plaque up on the wall, and here's what it said. It said, prayer is our humble answer to the inconceivable surprise of living. It is all we can offer in return for the mystery by which we live. Prayer is meaningless unless it is subversive, unless it seeks to overthrow and ruin the pyramids of callousness, hatred, opportunism, falsehoods. That was from Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. And then underneath it, it said, true peace is not merely the absence of tension. It is the presence of justice. I am cognizant of the interrelatedness of all communities and states. I cannot sit idly by in Atlanta and not be concerned about what happens in Birmingham. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And that obviously is from Reverend Martin Luther King, and also kind of set the tone for that whole meeting of being one of where you had chills the whole time. Thank you all so much. Have a great weekend. Thanks for all you're doing. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.